This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. About 200 people have been estimated killed in Iraq's capital, Baghdad, after a refrigerator truck full of explosives detonated on a busy street in the Karada neighborhood. Iraqis had been out late on Sunday in preparation for the end of Ramadan. It was the single worst attack in Iraq since 2003, when a bombing claimed 215 lives. The Iraq attack came just days after a major hostage situation ended in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. An upscale cafe frequented by foreigners was targeted by at least five gunmen who took hostages, separated the Muslims from the non-Muslims, and stabbed a number of people to death. The attack ended when Bangladeshi commandos stormed the cafe, killing at least five of the attackers, and at least 28 people were dead at the end of the night. The Islamic State claimed credit for the Baghdad attack, while a Bangladesh-based fundamentalist organization that has pledged allegiance to ISIS is apparently responsible for the attack in Dhaka. With these incidents coming on the heels of the attacks at Istanbul Airport in Turkey, many are wondering how great the Islamic State reach has become. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and a news analyst. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, as well as The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. Welcome back to the program, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
Let's talk about Iraq first. This is, of course, a huge attack with 200 people estimated killed. How do you view this particular attack within what the sort of spectrum of attacks that the Islamic State has carried out? What does it represent in terms of the Islamic State's sort of war strategy, if you will?
Well, first, Sonali, I'd just like to point out that there's another attack which people sometimes don't really lump into the same categories, but if I remember correctly, in 2007, there was a massive bombing attack against Yazidis that killed over 500 people, which would make it actually the single worst of the suicide bombing attacks. This attack is in some ways a reversion to business as usual during the Iraq occupation. So Karada was actually always a favored target, and in particular with truck bombs. There's a large busy street there, and it's fairly easy to get that kind of access. So Karada has seen mass casualty attacks like this on a number of occasions in the last 13 years, although this is, I guess, the biggest in terms of absolute numbers, over 200 killed and a similar number wounded. In terms of the ISIS strategy, I think that the Karada attack in particular represents continuity. I mean, this is attacks in the parts of Iraq not controlled by ISIS are not only, you know, have been, not only have they been quite common, there's been a pattern of doing them in retaliation after military engagements, especially perceived military defeats, like the rather ignominious exit of ISIS from Fallujah just recently. So
right.
This is a way of just, again, showing strength.
So yes, Iraqi media and others are reporting that because the Iraqi government, with U.S. help, managed to retake Fallujah, which is just a few dozens of miles from Baghdad, back from ISIS, that this particular bombing is likely directly related to that. And do you think that that's likely to be true?
Yes, and in a general sense, I think they have a definite orientation towards specific tit-for-tat attacks and, you know, shows of strength when people might perceive weakness. But it's also true clearly that this is a time of heightened attacks in a number of places in the world. I mean, Bangladesh, Istanbul, multiple attacks in Saudi Arabia, including in Medina. That one doesn't hear about a lot of those attacks. So a lot of things are going on right now. And in a way, although it's the most destructive, the attack in Baghdad is the most sort of normal of the attacks.
Now, what responsibility does the Iraqi government bear? I saw this bizarre report that the Iraqi government had come under, had basically been at the center of a scandal for using fake bomb detectors for security a number of years ago, and that they had pledged to remove those. The Iraqi interior minister has just resigned after this bombing in Karada. Does the Iraqi government bear a big responsibility for not keeping its civilians safe?
Yeah, you know, there are so many stories about Iraq which you simply couldn't make up. I mean, if they weren't true, no one could ever have thought of them. And the fact that after the 10 years later, the government is still using so-called bomb detectors that they know don't work, is almost par for the course in a way, in terms of the sort of overall incompetence of the government at, you know, basic governing. Say what you will about Saddam's government, there are a lot of things to say. They never showed quite the same level of lack of ability to control and to govern. So yeah, this story is pretty stunning. I mean, I'd known about the fake bomb detectors long ago, but I would not have imagined that they were still using them. So yes, obviously the government bears a fair amount of responsibility for this, but it's also true that it's difficult or impossible to police the major thoroughfares in Baghdad. I would say probably, given the fact that Karada has been a target so many times, that there ought to be, you know, checkpoints on getting in and out. But then again, it's a target because it's also, you know, lots of traffic goes through there for good reason. So these are the kinds of things that it's just very difficult for any government to guard against. And you can see, and I don't think anyone can fault the Turkish government for the security they have around Atatürk Airport. But all that high security meant was that the bombs went off outside and probably killed fewer people, but still killed people who were waiting to get into the airport. So I would definitely blame them, but I wouldn't go overboard on it.
What has the Iraqi government found in Fallujah after retaking that city? I mean, Fallujah is one of Iraq's major cities. After having it being controlled by ISIS for a while, what have Fallujah's residents gone through? I mean, it's hard to imagine.
So yeah, so some of the stuff that they've gone through with ISIS is actually similar to the things they went through with precursors of ISIS. So I mean, ISIS grows out of Al Qaeda in Iraq, and the kinds of atrocities, the kinds of excesses that, you know, range from abduction and torture of people, sometimes for ideological offenses, sometimes for money, rape or the simple, you know, acquisition of women that fighters from these groups decide they want to marry or otherwise be involved with, things like that. Those kinds of things have been routine among the more, you know, the more, let's say, extreme and violent of the groups operating in that area since probably 2004 or 2005, with some ups and downs. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing very little evidence that ISIS was doing anything positive in terms of governance. I mean, they actually, unlike previous incarnations, make a big deal out of propaganda about how well they govern, but in actual fact, that's mostly illusion, much like what Donald Trump says about how he might govern.
So this bombing, truck bombing in Iraq, was directly carried out, as far as we know, by ISIS, or ISIS, you know, directly was able to conduct it. But let's talk about what happened in Bangladesh just a few days before the Iraq attack. This was a hostage situation where there were basically at least five, maybe six men wearing t-shirts and jeans, you know, just looking like any other ordinary young people, some of them in their teens and some in their 20s, just walking in and took hostages. And apparently this is by a Bangladesh-based organization that has claimed allegiance to ISIS. Now, Bangladesh has its own set of unique problems. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about what has led up to this attack with the horrible trend of the stabbings and hacking to death of atheist bloggers in Bangladesh, and whether you think that is related to what happened in Dhaka at the cafe.
All right, so Bangladesh has two sort of larger structural problems purely in the political realm without getting into the number of other problems like the way that they're imperiled by climate change.
Right.
There is the antagonism between the two major parties, the Awami League and the Bangladesh National Party, both of them led by women, Sheikh Hasina and Khalida Zia, and they've been sort of trading back and forth the prime ministership. But despite the fact that there has been alternation in power, the relations between the two parties are actually extremely fraught, and in the last elections, the BNP effectively boycotted the election, so that the Awami League now is in a position to rule autocratically. Second, there is the continuing fallout of the 1971, the civil war and the birth of Bangladesh, and so not long ago, the government actually started considering, and at least in one case, actually handing down indictments with regard to crimes against humanity committed in the 1971 war. And it's actually after that that this incredible spate of targeted attacks on atheist bloggers, free thinkers, occasionally foreigners have started. And right now, I think the total tally is something like about 50 people killed in these various kinds of targeted attacks, some of them rather prominent, well-known bloggers and writers. And it's clearly connected to this latest phase in the sense that if they indict someone from the Jamaat-e-Islami, which is it means the Muslim Assembly, and it's closely affiliated these days with the Bangladesh National Party, then Islamist groups are going to seek revenge, and they've sought revenge on atheist and agnostic bloggers and so on, and increasingly on foreigners. And the government has chosen to take a posture of mostly putting its head in the sand. Somehow they're very committed to denying that there's any connection with any local groups and ISIS, which is, in one sense, fine. You know, there are local groups that have their own agendas, and it's not like people are infiltrating from Iraq or Syria or Tunisia or other places into Bangladesh. On the other hand, ISIS has the incredible ability to broadcast propaganda and create converts and inspire plots around the world, not just in Bangladesh. And the connection there is something that is clearly ongoing. With regard to the latest attacks, obviously they're a change. They're much less targeted. They're targeted in the sense that they're against foreigners, and they also killed a few people that they decided were not sufficiently observing Muslims. But they're not targeted on specific intellectuals or political figures. And this attack makes it much more like typical ISIS attacks, although it's also quite different from most normal kind, which is something like the Karada attack, in that they took hostages, they applied criteria, they spared some Bangladeshis who they decided were sufficiently Islamic. ISIS usually doesn't do that. Attacks planned or by Al-Qaeda very often do that, so that's one distinction that people have been making. But in this case, it turns out ISIS has actually claimed responsibility for the attack. It's still a rather confusing mess of a situation, but one thing it may suggest is that ISIS is listening to Al-Qaeda when it says that it's important not to appear to be randomly killing any and all Muslims, which is what most of their attacks.
Right, yeah. So in Iraq, the majority, if not all, the victims Iraqis, and in Bangladesh, the majority were non-Bangladeshis. One of the Bangladeshis killed was a young man named Faraz Hussein, who would have graduated from Emory University next year, who happened to be the nephew of a good friend of mine. And this young man, about whom quite a lot has been written, was very brave, was actually offered the chance to leave his two friends and chose to stay with them. So it's just really kind of amazing how these things have been impacting so many ordinary people. The cafe that was targeted, a Holy Artisan Bakery in an upscale neighborhood in Bangladesh that attracted both foreigners but also Bangladeshis themselves. How do you think this particular tragedy is going to be dealt with by the Bangladeshi government? I asked you about the Iraqi government's responsibility for the attack in, or at least for not having enough security in Iraq. In Bangladesh, how do you see the government response unfolding in response to this attack?
So it's difficult to say these days in many such cases because of the fact that normally one assumes that most governments, you know, governments in countries that aren't failed states, will try to react effectively and rationally to something like this, which is clearly this is to quote the people who matter in Bangladesh, which is to say local elites and foreigners, the kind of people that governments like those pay a lot more attention to than they pay to the poor masses of their own country. So normally you would think that there would be a very strong reaction. In this case, it's not clear to me. I mean, there was a massive reaction earlier before the attack where over 10,000, some say up to 14,000 people were detained, supposedly in connection with these kinds of terrorist attacks that had been going on before. Although, you know, clearly one of the things it shows is that they have no idea how to profile who might be connected with those attacks and who might not be. Given the fact that they've already put out this incredible dragnet, it's not at all clear to me what the next step will be. And there are, as I said, some disconcerting signs that they want to suggest somehow that the attack was not really connected with ISIS, or perhaps that it's really something that has to do with the opposition political party. By the way, this is extremely common. The same thing happened in Turkey with the Istanbul attacks. There were hints that it might be the PKK instead of the ISIS, which are, you know, completely ridiculous. The PKK has never done anything like that and never contemplated it. But there is certainly the possibility of trying to make political fodder out of it instead of trying to deal with what is a real and rapidly growing problem.
Rahul, what about the fact that in Bangladesh, the attackers, at least the alleged attackers, and Bangladeshi media have been, you know, publishing photos of people who they say are the attackers. These were young men, some of them in their teens, but they were also apparently well-educated and from, you know, fairly affluent families, if it indeed it turns out to be corroborated and is true. What does that also represent? I mean, you know, there was a time when the stereotype of the Mujahideen warrior or the Taliban student was poor children, poor young boys who were being taken advantage of and brainwashed by fundamentalist forces in the Islamic State now because of their use of the internet and sophisticated propaganda, and this particular profile of the Bangladeshi attacker reveals a different kind of person. Does that, you know, do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, the truth is that revolutionary movements don't really start in almost all cases with recruitment of the poor. Once they become mass movements, the poor, of course, will preferentially be brought in. But it's very rare that they start that way. The Taliban, for example, they started among refugees, a very specific population that was displaced and where a certain kind of access was easy. Groups like Al-Qaeda and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, out of which a lot of the core of Al-Qaeda grew, a lot of these were you know, failed or successful engineering students, medical students, doctors, etc., people with some knowledge and some resources, because the kinds of attacks that they were involved with were things that required some kind of technical abilities. In this case, it's interesting because the idea that these young men were from elite schools in Bangladesh, I don't really know how to put that into the framework. But one thing that's obvious is if you're going to have attacks in countries like this, which are inspired by ISIS, the people who are going to be carrying them out are going to be people who have a lot of time to devote to being on the web with broadband access. And that's still in Bangladesh, at least, that's still a minority. In some countries, you know, in everywhere, the number of people who can do that is growing. But we're talking about to convert someone to this kind of attack takes a lot of time and effort. And so these had to be young men who had a lot of time on their hands to sit around watching videos and so on. So it makes sense to me that it's from this kind of demographic, although obviously it's very much right now shocking the Bangladeshi elites.
What conclusions can we draw from the attacks in Bangladesh, in Iraq, in Turkey, of where ISIS is as a whole? Because it's hard to sort of tell where ISIS is directly responsible. In countries like Iraq, it's obvious, and where ISIS is inspiring attacks or directing them. Can we draw conclusions about the reach of the organization ISIS, or can we only sort of conclude and assume that there are going to be many sort of copycat groups and groups inspired by ISIS that are going to be conducting such horrific attacks in the future?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I don't think that we should be thinking about it that way anymore. We should not make this rigid distinction between who's in ISIS, who's in ISIS's direct geographical reach, and who's inspired by ISIS. But insofar as it makes sense to distinguish, ISIS is in, Western Iraq and Eastern Syria. That's where it is. They can send people into Turkey. They can send people into Europe to lesser degrees. That's it. All right, they don't really, that's all they do, and that's all they're focused on. Everything else involves the use of the internet for spreading influence in a broadcast way without having to have the same kinds of personal and especially organizational and infrastructural connections. What we're finding, though, is that there are lots of places where people are getting sufficient know-how to plan attacks like these. Attacks like these are not necessarily easy to carry out. So in the case of Karada, or the case of Ataturk Airport, you definitely have people who were very much involved with armed groups before. In the case of Bangladesh, where the attack was definitely not carried out with the same level of sophistication, it's not clear what experience any of these young men had with any of this kind of attack before. So think about the two things to think about are the spreading of ISIS influence through their internet propaganda, and secondly, the ability of people who are actually influenced by this to carry out an attack. So the Orlando attack, Omar Mateen, he was highly trained in the use of firearms. It so happened. Attacks like this are sometimes carried out by people who are formerly members of the U.S. Armed Forces. Or obviously, there are people from the former Soviet Union. You have a long-standing tradition of armed rebellion among the Chechens. It's people like that getting in contact with ISIS through the use of social media that are going to be the next major wave of threats in terms of mass casualty attacks.
And of course, then it remains to be seen how the U.S. responds to all of this. Rahul, thank you so much for spending this time with us and sharing your insight with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and a news analyst. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. And he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can watch all of the videos of our interviews. We are a TV show now, so you can actually watch every single interview in addition to hearing it. We'll be back in a moment.